have a number of members of my committee that have been concerned that we don't know specifically enough about each specific section of this bill to really be able to function knowing the intent of the drafters of the bill. The drafters of the bill are sitting before me, and in a second, we're going to have them tell us their name, and then we're going to sort of informally begin to go through this bill in a section by section. I'm going to ask the committee and other members that are sitting with the committee to allow the panel to get through each individual section before we begin to ask questions about that given section, and we're going to take it all the way through. The other word is that we have another meeting set for 1:30 tomorrow. I hope between today and tomorrow we can get through each section of this bill and ask questions about it today and tomorrow. We can get through all the preliminary and housekeeping type amendments we expected to in the bill to get a fresh copy of the bill to finish it off next week or a few days thereafter. So I want to stress to the people that are watching that the panel of people before us are here specifically on the request of this committee to explain this bill to us, and they're not being given any kind of special privilege. They were the ones that drafted the bill, and we want to find out about why these sections are in here. So this is our chance to hear from the people that made the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
To follow that up, it was my feeling last week that while these folks brought us the bill originally, we never had a chance to hear the case be made for the sections in the original bill. If we're going to have alternative visions for what this bill is going to look like, it's just my sense that we need to know what the arguments are for and against each policy proposal. So it's specifically at my request, and I appreciate your willingness to work with me on this, and I appreciate the folks' willingness to come back.
Thank you, Representative Clark. It's a great pleasure to have our speaker, Vera Katz, here today. We put some great work into this package, and I'd like to have everyone state their name quickly for the record so we can hopefully get on with this in a more informal manner so we won't have to stick to too many formal rules that will take away from our time. Representative Katz, or Representative Burton.
For the record, I'm State Representative Mike Burton, District 17.
My name is Dave Marshall. I'm with the National Rifle Association of America.
My name is Dave Burks. I'm the Sheriff of Lane County.
My name is Corey McGregor. I'm Legislative Assistant for House Speaker Katz.
Brian Riley, Chief of Police, City of Salem, and representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police.
Dean Renfrew, Oregon State Police Criminal Investigation Bureau.
John Nichols, Oregon State Rifle and Pistol Association.
Lawrence Young, Oregon Attorney General's Office.
Mr. Chair, let me just briefly start again, and I appreciate you asking us. We did not have the opportunity to share the vision with you on the bill, and certainly we didn't have the opportunity, and we appreciate having you give this opportunity us to go through section by section and answer questions, share with you what the current law is and why the recommendations were made. When I called everybody into the office several months ago, I turned to John Nichols and I said, do we have a problem with the current situation in the state? His response was yes. I then asked him, what was the problem? He responded, identification. That led to the issue, if identification is the problem, can we devise a system where a Patrick Purdy, where in California and in Oregon, identification was the problem, can we devise a system where the Patrick Purdys of this world could be caught, in addition to dealing with prison space and tougher penalties? That's where we got to the issue of fingerprints as the only means of true identification. That's how we got to the need to increase the time for a criminal and mental health background check, neither one of which do we have in current statute. The statute is silent with regard to a criminal background check. It says nothing with regard to mental health background check. And that's the reason for the time increase. That then led to the loosening up of restrictions and devising a license that exempts the holder from a handgun waiting period. So that if you go through all of this, then the law enforcement people said, then we don't see a problem with allowing a license that would basically waive all the waiting periods. and we discussed, because everybody felt that we needed to increase the penalties for violators. The next issue was the issue of a waiting period for all firearms, not only handguns. There was an objection to that, and there was the gun lobby who then came with the concept of the study to build the database for further information as to do we or do we not have a problem in the state of Oregon with regards to long guns and semi-automatic. I also need to share with you, some of us want to divide the long guns with the semi-automatics. We were well educated by the interests that were working together with us that it is very hard to make a clear and clean distinction, since a long gun and a rifle is also and can be a semi-automatic. We set that aside and then focused in on a study using those tools we devised for handguns to get to the information on the study. As we went through all this, other ideas and other problems that John and the law enforcement people were aware of over the years popped up, and we then made a decision whether to deal with them in this comprehensive bill or set them aside for other bills. And that's what I would like now to turn to the groups that worked on the section by section to have you share, have them share with you why those changes were made and what they really mean. Thank you.
You have the definitions.
I am.
Mr. Chair, I assume we're working off Section 1 of the original bill, the printed bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, on Section 1 of the original bill, I can try to explain that particular section. The problem that came up concerning this particular section dealt with, first of all, proper and complete identification provided by the gun dealer to law enforcement agencies seemed to be lacking. In addition, the theory behind this this particular section had to deal with timeliness as far as a response by law enforcement doing the inquiry of the person purchasing the weapon. Current law required 120 hours or 5 days. Law enforcement felt that was insufficient time to do an adequate check. We discussed it for some period of time and chose 15 days based upon the fact that it would give sufficient time for the triplicate document to be forwarded to the state police general headquarters, where it could be checked through the computer, the fingerprints could be, and then it would allow time for a check to be made and then return to the local police agency, who is the recipient of the second copy of the form that's completed by the dealer. Now, that we felt could be accomplished within 10 days. An additional 5 days, we thought, would be utilized by the local agency to do further checks and then get back to the gun dealer with the appropriate information. We had to extend to 15 days because 5 days just simply was not long enough to complete the process. There was some doubt as to whether 15 days would be long enough. But we, after some lengthy discussions, did settle on 15 days.
Mr. Chair?
President Clark.
Can you tell me again the triplicate forms, where 1, 2, and 3 are going?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the first form, original remains with the dealer. The second, or the copy, goes to the local agency of jurisdiction, whether it be the city or other municipal law enforcement agency, or to a sheriff's department in the event that a local municipality is not available. And then the third copy, which contains the fingerprints, would go into the state police at General Headquarters Identification Bureau.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dwyer.
What part of the section requires you to check, actually make a check?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dreyer, Section 1, 3, B, and sub B. Department of State Police shall conduct a criminal records check of the purchaser using the thumbprints on the triplicate and shall send within 10 days of the date the triplicate mailed by the dealer, the triplicate with results of the record check to the agency that received the duplicate.
This is only the handguns. This is just handguns, Mr. Chair. Just want to clarify, because the statute does address all firearms. This is just handguns.
I understand that. What, under current law, you're not required, compelled by law, to make a check. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dreyer, that's correct.
Under current law, what do you do with the application? What happens to them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dreyer, I cannot answer that because the forms go into various law enforcement agencies, and I believe that there are a multitude of answers to that question, depending on what the particular policy or the situation of the particular police agency is. State police at this time do not receive any of those records for a check.
What about the local authorities? You've got the sheriff and the city police there. What do you do with them?
Chairman, Representative Dwyer, basically it is being made on the decision of priorities from jurisdiction to jurisdictions, and they vary according to the work demand placed upon them. In some jurisdictions, it's done faithfully and quickly. In others, it is of lesser priority. And I have been told, although I don't know this personally, in some cases, there is no response.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dwyer, Sheriff Burks, the issue there in terms of the sheriffs is that we issue the concealed weapons permits in this state, and there is a variety of different ways that that's handled at this time. Unfortunately, it is not consistent. And it goes back to the history of the charge for the cost of the fingerprinting. I believe originally it was free, and then for some reason or other it jumped to $10 that we had to pay for them to be checked. And because that took the whole fee, I think some sheriffs don't send in the prints at all. Others send them in selectively, and others send them all in. And those that are returned to us are generally, at least in our agency, are kept in the file with the applicant's information.
Well, this refers just to the purchase and not to the... to the application.
That's just referring to handguns.
Yes.
That's not long guns. But
you don't do anything with the purchase of a handgun.
We check the, Mr. Chair, Representative Dwyer, we check the records check of the name of the person that's on the form that's sent to us from the purchase of a gun.
You check the name?
See if that person is wanted.
In all cases?
I believe so.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Mannix.
Since we're having a section-by-section summary, I'd like to move on to Section 2.
If we can, there are a couple questions I want to get at real quick on Section 1. And this is something that's probably going to come up throughout, but one of the concerns that was expressed to us is when you get a hold of these fingerprints, I think it says in here that it's unlawful to compile or maintain this type of thing. We've had some suggestions that we either require the information to be destroyed after it's used, or for there to be criminal penalties or civil penalties against police agencies that violate this section. And I don't know if the committee has any specific recollection of what some of the proposals were, but I was hoping you could comment on those potentials, because I know that there's some interest on the committee to try to do something like that in this section.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
I was one of the people who expressed that concern, but it had to do with guns other than handguns. I want to be clear about that, because I don't want us to get confused. As I understand Section 1, it relates to handguns.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
I think that we...
Right. No, I understand it.
If I was recall Representative Clark's concern, I think his concern was about fingerprinting, but
right.
There was a separate concern about compiling of records. What if... Would there be any major concern if we went in here and required that those records be destroyed after they're used, or as a second alternative, that there be some civil or criminal penalties against a police agency that uses the records for any other purpose?
Mr. Chairman, Major Renfro here, if I may be allowed to answer that, or at least partly answer that. There was a concern about the fingerprint information being compiled and maintained at the Central Repository of the State Police. And we at the State Police would not maintain the fingerprint information. Assuming we had an AFIS system or an automated fingerprint system, that information would be checked, the fingerprints that is, would be checked against a database, a computerized database. And then once that information is returned, we would have to collect what information is necessary for the study. But then we would return the form, the original form that we received, to the agency, local law enforcement agency, that received the duplicate copy. We would not retain the fingerprints at all, nor would we retain information regarding the identity of the individual checked.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Major Renfro, the idea of returning the triplicate to the receiver of the duplicate versus returning the triplicate to the dealer. I'm wondering what the thought was. See, this paragraph says that the triplicate that OSP receives is sent back to the local police department or sheriff's office because they receive the duplicate. I'm wondering if... what the rationale was there versus sending the triplicate back to the gun dealer along with that, with the thumbprint that's on the triplicate.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bryan, there is no objection from State Police viewpoint other than just to bring up a point. The triplicate copy with the fingerprints, we would somehow on the form have to indicate whether or not this person disqualified or not. And it was our thinking originally when we came up with this draft is that information would be put on the triplicate form and returned to the local agency with whether or not the individual had a record or met other criteria that would disqualify the individual. To us, however, it would make basically no difference who we sent it to as long as we did not retain it and did discard it to the appropriate agency or dealer.
Mr. Chairman? Dave Marshall with the National Rifle Association. One of the concerns we had was that in as it relates to the fingerprinting on handguns only, that the information, if the individual is not a prescribed individual, is not a felon or fall into the prescribed category, that information either be destroyed or sent back to, find its way back to the applicant himself. That attendant with the criminal sanctions for any type of law enforcement agency to compile that information makes us feel much better. That was the objective that we have, and we had raised that point as well.
Any problems with that? Anybody on the panel? Yes.
Representative Chief Riley, the concern we have is not with those that have made an application that is appropriate under the law, but is a major piece of evidence in a case for prohibited persons. And so while I understand the concern, and we have no interest in maintaining the file of fingerprints for legitimate purchases of firearms, if it is an illegal purchase, then that is a major piece of evidence of that illegal purchase.
Well, as I understand the bill, you run your records check and you find out someone who is prohibited, a felon, has just applied for a handgun. You'd be able to maintain that document, wouldn't you, and go ahead and say, all right, we're not returning this. We're refusing the authorization, and we're going to prosecute you for a false application. Is that right?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to respond to your original question about the keeping of the information. Sheriff Burks is my name. If the fingerprints are what we're talking about, I don't really have a great problem with that. But if you're talking about some of the suggested language that I've seen in one of the working documents.
Could you speak up just a little bit for me?
Yes,
maybe you can pull the microphone closer.
It's got a short cord.
And on your voice, not the mic, because these speakers, we don't hear them very well.
Okay. The concern I have is that some suggested language I saw in the working document dated May 2nd talked about all records. And I have no concern once a record check is made with perhaps destroying the fingerprints, but you would need to be sure and bring the public records law into compliance, I believe, if you do that, because currently we're required to hold those type of documents. I believe it's 5 or 7 years. The rest of the information, however, I think is very important, because if you look at Section 30, the sheriff in the current language is required to do a study of permits denied, and so you're going to have to maintain some information. Fingerprints, I don't think, are absolutely essential unless you have a case where you want to show that the prohibited person was actually attempting to buy a handgun. Then it would be necessary for an element of proof to have the fingerprint.
Let me summarize, Mr. Chair. I think it's fair to say that everybody around this table had no intention to have these fingerprints sitting on file, whether it's at the state police or at the local jurisdiction, and that we did discuss that. And as long as there are no red flags and nothing comes up, as the checks are done, the fingerprint piece of information can either be sent to the local jurisdiction or returned to the purchaser.
One other item. And Mr. Chairman, is that quite often we are approached as law enforcement officials by private citizens who want a record of their firearms. And so I would not want to be prohibited, and fingerprints aside, I would not
want
to be prohibited from.
Can they record their own firearms?
Yes.
They can't figure out what they own.
No, it's just it's
in case of theft.
Insurance purposes, whatever. If it is amended to say we can keep no records of firearms ownership, then we're going to do a disservice to a number of people in our state.
Mr. Chairman? Well, is there any need for the state to be performing that function if someone wants to document ownership of a firearm? Can't they just provide that documentation to an insurance company?
Yeah, absolutely.
Chief Riley?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, that's correct. They could.
Okay. Great.
The other question I wanted to get into in this section was one that we dealt with in the last work session. And I think this, I'm not trying to slow us down too much, but this is a question that's going to be coming up later on anyway. We should probably address it now, and we'll find that we have less and less to do as the bill goes on. The question of identification in here, and in terms of what pieces you need to show. Now, we, in the last work session, amended the bill to say you needed to have two pieces of identification. One with a picture. We thought that the requirement, as we read this bill, the requirement for a birth certificate was unreasonable, and in fact was probably not the intent of the framers to include in the bill. If we could get some comments as to that specific section of section one and this is something that'll come up throughout the bill, but in the application form, and then potentially we can maybe explore Representative Mannix's notion for if you'd like to, his proposed amendment along with the same. I think we get into this question of how good is the DMV driver's license, and is it good enough to be used for anything? And maybe that's
may I address that briefly, Mr. Chairman?
Please, Representative Mannix.
I'd like to redirect, and I know that some folks in this audience here today had been interested in this approach. The more I look at the approach, the more I just like to have us conduct a study for 2 years of taking the proactive approach. Right now, there's going to be an interim study by the Transportation Committee in regard to the motor vehicle license to tighten up the whole motor vehicle license process in Oregon so that it means something to have a motor vehicle license, that you can't just walk in with three scraps of paper and get a motor vehicle license. And I remember the gentleman from the NRA had testified earlier that, for instance, in Virginia, motor vehicle licenses really are licenses for individuals who exist, and they banks will accept them as identification because they know that they're legitimate and so on and so forth, whereas Oregon's system is so full of holes that anybody can fraudulently procure a motor vehicle permit in Oregon very easily. And so just for everyone's information, I'm redirecting my effort towards trying to say, as part of this interim study that's going to be done on tightening up the motor vehicle license, that we also look for an that we cooperate with that and work with that while this system is being worked on, to see if we could have a system where you can identify yourself as a law-abiding Oregonian on even that motor vehicle license and use that as your identification for firearms purchases. And my goal would be with no waiting period, that you walk in and you've got a firearms validation on your motor vehicle permit, and the motor vehicle system is so tight that not anybody can get a motor vehicle permit without some decent identification. That's something that I'm not going to go into the details on it, because as I've worked it out talking to a lot of individuals, I just see it's not going to work to try to slip it in at this point on this bill as an alternative. And I'm just going to propose that we work with the Transportation Committee on that study.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the direction that Representative Mannix is going, because I saw a lot of problems. I'd like to come back and hear from the proponents of the bill as to the bill as drafted, the identification requirements, what your thinking was, why the birth certificate or the naturalization certificate or the alien registration card, these sorts of things, and I mean, to defend or at least explain the menu that you've got in there right now, because it caused some problems for us in terms of figuring out how many people actually have their birth certificate, how many don't, and it's a sticky problem. So maybe you could just explain the bill as drafted.
Chairman, let me just say a few words about that. Representative Burton, that there was quite a bit of discussion around that, and the discussion revolving around whether there should be two pieces of ID or not. And in reference to what Representative Mannix is saying, I have a bill down in the Transportation Committee that would finally require Oregon to have a duplicate photo. When you get your license in this state, they take one photograph, and there's no duplicate kept anywhere, which is one of the reasons there is so much fraud. I mean, it's just as simple a move as that is creating quite a stir in the DMV to move us for that because of the cost. So there's a long way we have to go to get legitimized on the question of getting a driver's license. But what we really need to do is try to find something which would give a positive ID. And the things that are listed here are those things which would normally be available to only that individual as a means of ID. In other words, not readily available. And we talked at some point in the discussion about at least one of those that had some sort of photograph identification as well as a license or an address identification. So there was quite a bit of discussion around at least two, having two kinds of documentation that would collaborate each other in the application. And these are the lists that came up. Incidentally, I believe most of this is in current law. So I'm not too certain that we made any changes. In fact, this is current law.
Correct me, but it's my understanding under current law you don't have to show any identification to buy a gun at all.
I think that would also apply to a handgun. Isn't that correct? Does anybody dispute that?
No, that's not correct.
Representative Dwyer, help us out.
To buy a handgun, you have to satisfy the federal requirements under the law. If you'll look in my -1 amendments, you'll see what's currently asked to buy a firearm in the state of Oregon, a handgun.
I have it. I know what it is. Why don't you enlighten us as to what those are?
Mr. Chair, this is our bill.
Mr. Chair, can we get an answer from the people in front of us? I mean, Representative Dwyer is going to be here, and we're going to be able to hear from him. But these folks are not, and I want to talk to these folks.
If I can, let me Representative Dwyer's the federal law requires the person to either personally know you or get numbers off of one piece of identification. It doesn't specify what piece of identification. Apparently, it could even be your library.
I mean, it's not a hard question. What is existing law? What kind of ID do I have to show to get
under
a gun
Oregon
under existing law?
You don't have to show any ID for purchase of a firearm.
Any gun at all?
Under Oregon law.
Thank you.
And that's the federal law. Would there be, what would this panel think about us moving into conformance with that federal law? Either you know the person or you get the numbers off of one of their pieces of identification. Would that, in your eyes, be adequate?
Mr. Chairman, Major Renfro, let me just explain what we went through in trying to establish positive identification. Just any identification wasn't sufficient for us, particularly in law enforcement. We have a problem in Oregon, and we've mentioned the driver's license with being falsified. We seem to have additional problems with any other type of identification that isn't a government-type issue, generally. And so what we tried to do when we selected this menu, so to speak, is select those identifications that are, in at least most instances, not normally reproduced or falsified. And we tried to list sufficient numbers. There's, I believe, five there, to where they could pick any one to show the individual's origin, where they were born or so forth. We struggled with that. We are not comfortable, for the most part, with just any type of identification. And I, for one, am not real comfortable with a library card or a credit card, but really do want something that happens to originate from some type of government agency to show identification.
Judge. Another comment?
Section 10.
All right. Mr. Chairman, Lawrence Young of the Attorney General's Office. If you are proposing that driving while suspended, the felony that you get under that particular conviction, should not be a bar to purchase of a rifle or other sort of firearm, I'd like to report that the committee considered that sort of issue, because there are a lot of felony crimes out there that have nothing to do with violence. Most of your white-collar crimes, in fact, have nothing to do with violence, embezzlement, that sort of thing. The committee and the working group, when it considered this, finally decided that a felon is a felon is a felon, and that if they decided they needed to carry a rifle, they could go and apply for relief under Section 10. That's how this particular committee dealt with that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Question for the Attorney General's Office. Different issue altogether, but can a convicted felon vote?
Chairman, I'm not...
Do you know off the top of your head?
I do not know off the top of my head. I do not believe they can.
Used to be you couldn't, and I...
My guess is, if I remember reading the Constitution correctly, when they're after they get off of parole...
Yes, me.
They get off of parole, or after they... If the sentence is 20 years, they can't vote for 20 years, even if they get out too. That's not correct.
Yeah, but the point being that we... Okay.
No, I think...
Well, that's fine. It's a tangent... question. I can figure out the answer to it later. That's fine. I don't want to derail the process here.
Okay, we got any other comments on this section?
Anybody have any other concerns on this
section? We had one brought to us about, is this section going to affect, wait a minute, I think I might have missed something on the previous section. Is the previous section going to affect somebody that tries to give a gun to their son? They got a 17-year-old child. Is there any intent to keep them from being able to give a rifle to their son? How about a handgun?
Chairman, in fact, this is an improvement over current statutes. Earlier, I heard earlier testimony in another session, someone that had that concern, and they were actually violating the law today versus what's allowed under this. And we had long discussions about the legitimate use of people, young people, and recognized by law enforcement, and traveling to and from, all the kinds of things that they're used with. And this was an attempt to clarify that and give recognition to legitimate possession of firearms by young people.
Chairman, if I could direct the panel then to page 8, lines 11 and 12, and it says, nothing in this section shall be construed as prohibiting
the parent or guardian of a minor child from giving the minor child a firearm other than a handgun. So it would appear to restrict the ability of a parent to give a child a handgun.
Is it the intent of the intent to restrict the right of the parent to give his child a handgun?
Mr. Chairman, John Nichols. Currently, under federal law, a person under 21 is prohibited from having a handgun. The exemptions, which do not appear in here, it's that have all the exemptions from needing a permit and everything else, I believe, would cover target practice and whatever. At least that's what the law enforcement community assured us when we talked about possibly taking out other than the handgun, which is current law in Oregon.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. The next lines do exempt hunting, target practice, and other lawful purposes.
Any firearm.
So that's basically in just compliance with the federal requirement, the way that's written now.
All righty.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Bryan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bryan, with respect to that, Sheriff Burks, with respect to that, there was a concern raised. I don't know if we had much discussion on it, but there perhaps should be a small amendment there that says that this subsection does not extend to a minor with a child with a history of violence or who would otherwise be prohibited from owning or possessing a firearm under the previous section 21B through J of this Act.
Well,
and I would urge the committee
question.
To consider that. It perhaps cleans the language up a little bit and makes it conform.
Do you have that language?
Yes, it was submitted. It should be in your packet, Representative Bryan. It's under Clackamas County heading.
Oh,
like this.
Okay. Thank you. I think I have seen that.
Extend the list, basically the list, consider persons list into kids that would
so we don't want to just give, we want to be sure.
Kids who would qualify, if you have a child who has been committed to the Oregon State Hospital psychiatric unit, that a parent should not transfer a gun to that child. That's basically the intent of what
that's
you're saying.
That's the intent of
got
the
it.
Promotion, or the amendment.
I can understand
it possibly. Okay. Let's bounce on. Is there anything else in Section 3 we need to touch on? Section 4, all current laws, anything happening in Section 4 we need to.
Section 4 is all brand new. And this gives access by law enforcement to the law enforcement data system to records from the Health Division, be given the responsibility. And they are to make a determination if a person is of such mental health to be a dangerous to self to others, and they are to report that on forms provided by the Health Division. This is to address the concern law enforcement has of now of having no access to that information. It also provides for protection for the provider of that information for immunity.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding Section 4 has been or is being reworked.
Let
or,
me,
you know?
This is a major issue for both groups, the gun lobby and law enforcement. Section 4, the way it currently stands, is for the most part unworkable from what we've heard from various folks. And we are the intent of expanding this to more than just felons and people who are mentally unstable or mentally dangerous, that's the intent of Section 4. Larry Young helped produce Section 4. And he was going to address this section and the constitutionality issues involved.
Mr. Chair, I was not actually going to address the constitutionality issues involved. It's Lawrence Young of the Attorney General's office. The intent, clearly, we've heard discussion today in front of the committee that we don't want people who are mentally unstable to be able to go in and buy firearms. And one of the problems that we have is how do we know that somebody is mentally unstable? This section was designed to provide some sort of procedural mechanism for reports to be made to some sort of repository, and in this case the Health Division was picked, so that there would be some way to come up with the information on who is mentally unstable. There are problems we've heard from, this committee has heard from several lobbyists representing mental health professionals regarding the breadth of Section 4. And at this point, the working group is intending to meet with those professionals and try and come up with some language that is acceptable to both the professionals and to this particular group. And for that reason, we would ask that you perhaps not spend a whole lot of time on this particular issue today. We'd like to come back to you on it.
I'd like to jump back to Section 3 for a moment. we were talking about felonies and all of that good stuff. Why are we exempting a prior conviction of a felony if the offense was for possession of marijuana? Why don't we make that person apply?
We will.
We're going to.
That's in the proposed amendment. Oversight.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That was
marijuana wasn't the crime.
We had to get that section in the bill in order to get the Flower Child generation to sign on to it, Representative Mannix. It's part of a compromise.
I think it's appropriate.
Woodstock generation.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bryan.
With regard to Section 4, I know we don't want to get into an extensive discussion of it, but we have discussed some options to it, and Holly's done some work on it. I'd like to ask Holly to give the panel a brief summary of where we're heading to get their response while they're here.
You want to do that now, or you want to try to, let's get through it.
I can just do it very briefly and just get an initial reaction from them, I think would be helpful.
Just for this section?
Just for Section 2 and Section 4, since we're just right here.
Let's do that, Holly. Why don't we?
One of the suggestions that has been raised has been to delete Section 4 in its entirety and add things to Section 2 that are clearly documentable, I guess, for lack of a better word, because of the numerous problems that have been raised in Section 4. And somehow expanding the list and making the list in Section 2 a little bit more comprehensive, but I think based on objective data as opposed to subjective reporting. Assuming that the committee can move in that direction, what's your reaction?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Robinson, we talked about that in a meeting just prior to this particular hearing today with respect to perhaps just going to some sort of standard where you have to have a civil commitment. You've been committed because you're dangerous to self or others. And at that point, there was an agreement, an informal agreement by the committee, that we were not willing to endorse that concept at this point. We wanted to talk with the mental health professionals regarding it because there was some concern that that was narrowing it too far, and it was the net result was going to be that there would be, the bill would be missing the mark. It would not be getting a lot of people that it should be getting, such as the Purdy's of the world.
Well, I think that the distinction would perhaps be one of the suggestions that was made would be a little bit broader than civil commitments, but would perhaps include actual hospitalizations for dangerousness or some action other than, I mean, inpatient treatment as a criteria. I mean, I understand going a little bit further than actual commitments, but not going so far as any person that's in outpatient treatment.
Temporary police holds,
inpatient commitments, I mean, inpatient hospitalizations. I mean, there are other things between civil commitments and outpatient treatment.
Certainly the intent of the group, Mr. Chair, is to come up with some more objective criteria than are currently present in this bill. And all of the things that Ms. Robinson is describing are certainly more objective because some sort of event has taken place. However, you know, there's always problems with that, too, because a police officer hold essentially depends upon the discretion of the police officer. You know, that may or may not be appropriate for a criteria.
In regard to those events taking place, though, all that does is trigger a refusal to authorize the purchase. It doesn't say that that's a forever refusal. Person would inquire, well, why am I refused? Well, because we have this event, a police hold for mentally dangerous. Then that person can say, I challenge that. And if we said the government has the burden at that point, then I'm pretty comfortable saying I don't mind having a laundry list of mental incidents that tell me this guy might be unbalanced and I don't want him to go out and get a gun. But if he challenges my refusal to let him get his hands on a gun, then we have the burden of showing that he's mentally dangerous. What do you think of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, under current federal law, 18 U.S. Code, Section 922H4, it's unlawful for any person who's been adjudicated a mental defective, their term, or who has been committed to any mental institution to receive a firearm that has been shipped or transported in interstate commerce. That law was challenged in U.S. District Court and held to be unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court granted review, and in a decision in 1986, which was the U.S. Department of Treasury Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms versus Galeotto, the Supreme Court essentially kicked the case out because Congress went in and amended the law and provided just the sort of appeal mechanism that you were mentioning. There is a method by which you can petition the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Section 10 of this particular bill also contains provisions for some sort of hearing or appeal on that. And there are other amendments that are being proposed by other groups regarding reporting what happens when that report goes to the Health Division should the person be informed at that particular time that a report has been made to the Health Division and be given an opportunity to contest at that particular point. That issue is also on the table.
So it's okay to have these trip levers as long as somebody can challenge the result of the trip lever. That is, hey, that really doesn't apply here. I'm not really dangerous.
Right. The clear implication coming out of that Supreme Court decision was as long as there's some mechanism by which you can challenge it, it may well be held to be constitutional.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Any other comments in Section 4? We're going to keep going until 3:30, then we'll take about a 10-minute break and come back and try to get through the rest of the bill. I don't expect we're actually going to be working the bill today, but hopefully getting some more good information on the bill than work it tomorrow. Section 5, anything we should know about this one?
Mr. Chair, Major Renfro here, if I may explain that. Currently, the law requires that police agencies and courts report the arrests and dispositions on felonies and misdemeanors involving substance violations and sexual conduct crimes. This would add additional misdemeanors involving violence. And to go along with the capturing this information through the criminal history system, so that when a records check is conducted on a set of fingerprints, that information will be available.
That's 290. I'm supposed to talk to it. I could have read that section 6 times, and I never would have figured out that that's why that was in there. That's real helpful.
Helps to have you here, because we... did you understand that, Counsel?
Yes.
Counsel, I wish you'd speak up at some of these work sessions. Section 6 doesn't look too...
Just to flag it, Mr. Chair, section that ORS is repealed, and the next 7 and 8 are all new languages and light type. So if anybody in the audience, when we tell them if it's light, it's old. In this case, it's light and it's new.
We're repealing the concealed permit statute right? Concealed weapon permit.
And then putting in another one.
Placing it.
Thank you.
Section 7.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Nichols. The reason we repealed, if I may, the current concealed weapons license section is that it leaves too much to the subjective judgment of the sheriff. Some counties issue virtually upon request, and some counties don't issue at all. There's also the a permit is only valid for one particular firearm. If somebody has three chief specials, for example, one of them appears on his license, and if he happens to pick up the other one, one of the other two by mistake and gets stopped, he can be arrested for carrying a concealed firearm without a license. We've substituted...
Before you get to that, Mr. Chair, I need to explain this because it's been questioned... my motives on this have been questioned. Multnomah County, there are only 11 permits, concealed handgun permits. The reason for that is because the sheriff in Multnomah County basically doesn't issue them. And if you ask my personal opinion, I can give you one. But if you're gonna deal with this issue fairly and equitably, it doesn't seem that we ought to have statutes that are unevenly enforced across the state. Now, it isn't only Multnomah County. There are other counties, too. And that's why, as we put this bill together, with the approval of the law enforcement agencies, we devised a system that would be standard for the entire state and, in fact, has made some of my friends in Multnomah County unhappy.
Appreciate that. This is a very important section of the bill. Anybody want to give us more comments on Section 6 or something on Section 7?
You're not
finished it, are you?
No, I interrupted him. I apologize.
Totally lost my train of thought, so somebody else wants to pick up
while I'm... Mr. Chairman,
for telling us the concealed weapon permit statute stinks because anybody can do what they want under it. You like the new provisions because it sets up objective standards which are not susceptible to subjective judgments.
That's basically it.
That's what I thought you were telling us.
Gee, just gave my testimony for him. We also, and this was copied out of the Florida bill and subject to some, quite a bit of discussion back and forth, we put in a competency standard that is basically intended to show that someone knows which end of the gun the bullet is coming out of. If somebody can't meet one of those seven criteria that are listed there, they're in trouble. There's also no time limit. So if you were, say, in the service 20 years ago and could prove it, you've met the competency requirement because it'd be presumed that you would have a firearm or could would know how to use a firearm. We also, and I'm not sure it's in this section, require the state police to examine concealed weapons laws of other states and make up an approved list of out-of-state permits which will be honored provided they substantially meet the Oregon criteria. This is kind of at the request of a Washington attorney who threatens to sue the state if we don't allow him to get a permit. But
does it work the other way, John?
Pardon?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Does it work the other way? Are there other states that have essentially reciprocity with are there other states out there that have reciprocity with some sort of a system that we would now be able to plug into?
I'd have to defer that to Mr. Marshall because I'm not too familiar with whether there are any other states that have reciprocity on concealed weapons licenses.
Yeah, reciprocity. There are states that have reciprocity, but whether or not with Oregon, Washington, I'd have to check out with our people in Washington. Right. They have that information compiled.
Now, whether this would get us into that network or not, you're not clear on.
Yes, sir. California generally doesn't, but Nevada, for instance, does, I believe. And I couldn't answer that correctly right now. I will try and get that information if the committee would care to have that information.
Seems to me that if there are things technical that we can do in our process that will qualify Oregonians for reciprocity in other states, that might be a way to improve the bill from the standpoint of gun owners.
Surely.
If it doesn't substantially change the requirements of Section 7.
I know it would be respected in Vermont.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, John Nichols.
Sometimes.
Again. The state of Washington would not honor an Oregon permit. However, they will issue a permit to an out-of-state resident on the same basis that they will issue to a resident of that state. We discussed that, and law enforcement's view, I believe, and they can correct me, was that they would rather not have to issue to an out-of-state resident, but if the criteria in the home state were was substantially the same, they would be willing to honor it. Is that basically the...
Okay.
Mr. Chairman. Could we or should we put a section in here that says, that directs the appropriate state agencies to work on reciprocity agreements with other states, particularly California, Idaho, and Washington, to seek to expedite the permit process in other states?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of confidence with the California authorities in this matter.
Let's limit it to Idaho and Washington. And Guam.
Guam. In Vermont.
Mr. Any comment on the idea of seeking reciprocity?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, Sheriff Burks, I don't think law enforcement would object to that as long as the standards were very similar. And that was our concern. The biggest thing I've heard from my colleagues who issued permits is, I don't want to honor Oklahoma, or I don't want to honor Tennessee, because I don't really know what their standards are. And so that's why this was talked about, and the state police was given the task of making a study, if you will, to see if there were similar standards, and then we would honor their bill.
Study provision due then for us that we can work on it and look at it and then deal with reciprocity in a couple of years with the study. Major Renfro, are you agreeing with that?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Sheriff Percy, and there are a couple of other things that should be brought to your attention in this. The fingerprints are required under the current law. Additionally, they will have to be photographed. That's not current law, although many of us do photograph and put their pictures on the concealed weapons license. The fee is increased, and that's to cover the fingerprint checks and to cover the extra work. the there's an element for the loss of a for a duplicate to be issued for $10. The exemption for criminal for civil or criminal liability for the lawful performance of the sheriff's duties is there. And there still is some discretion, which I think you may have had some discussion about, that the sheriff retained, that you needed to clean up the language a little bit, because there is a section in there that says the sheriff, if I can find it real quick.
Page 12, line 10. Well, page 12, line 9.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Mannix.
Sheriff, would it be fair to say that that provision is basically, you've got someone who comes in and you may not have a criminal record on him, you may not have a hospital record on him, but you know from his record in the community that he's crazy, or you think he is, and you can pretty well say, hey, look, I've seen you doing all these crazy things. They're not crimes, but you sure seem like a very dangerous person to me, and I'm therefore going to deny you a concealed weapons permit.
Chairman, Representative Mannix, that is absolutely correct. You do have to articulate in writing why it's denied and it is appealable into the circuit court, so that relief can be granted if the individual can show that he should be issued the license.
Mr. Chair, need to flag that currently is not the language, and we felt that if you're going to go through this process, you ought to tell the applicant why that license is denied and give an applicant an opportunity to appeal, and everybody agreed to that.
May I inquire about something else on this, Mr. Chairman? Since you bring up the appeal process, would you be comfortable saying that the appeal process should be, and I'm just going to outline this real quickly for everyone and get a reaction, because this is an area that has to be addressed in terms of amendments, and we'll have to talk to the state court administrator too. Just say that you can go to the local district court or circuit court, and that you be able to present your own petition. It doesn't have to be something where you have to get an attorney, but you could, there'd be a form made available for you to simply say, I challenge this denial of the concealed weapon permit, and require that the court at least weekly or some reasonable time interval allow people to simply appear in person, just like in small claims court, in front of the judge and explain their reasons, and require the sheriff to appear with them or a sheriff's representative to explain his reasons. I'm trying to simplify the procedure and just say you get in front of a judge fast. No fancy lawyers needed, no fancy documents needed, a simple form that you fill out, you turn it into the court, you pay maybe a $1 filing fee, some token filing fee to mean that you're serious, and get in there right away for a quick appearance. The judge can hear the sheriff or sheriff's representative, hear the applicant who's been denied, give them that one shot at a judicial tribunal, and then say, okay, what the judge says goes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Representative Mannix, Section 11 of the bill currently provides that a person who's denied a handgun license or various other things regarding a handgun license can petition the circuit court to review the denial or the revocation. The intent of the working group was to do just as you have suggested, provide some sort of simplified process. Representative Katz and others repeatedly requested that there be the simplest possible process by way of appeal, and there a lot of consideration was given to some sort of administrative process with an administrative hearings officer, but in the end it was finally concluded that perhaps the simplest thing would be to go to circuit court, and that perhaps forms be put out by the state court administrator's office so that you could simplify that process. So that the general thrust of your comments is agreeable to the working group.
Okay. We had a lot of testimony from people saying, does this mean I have to hire a lawyer and file fancy documents? What we should probably do, though, is amend this to specify very clearly how simple this procedure should be, and what information needs to be provided. And basically, you provide a copy of your application with a simple statement that you want to challenge it, and maybe a $5 filing fee. Some very quick timeline that the court must hear it and allow you to appear in person with a representative of the Sheriff's Department. That's all right. So we should write something in there. I want to see it in the law, though, so it's clear. All right.
Mr. Chairman?
We need, just to clarify something, if I might, Mr. Chair, if I recall the testimony of the State Court Administrator's Office, if you want it simple, it basically has to go to district court, and that's circuit court.
Mr. Marshall.
two points, Mr. Chairman. Responding to Mr. Representative Mannix's inquiry. On the front end of that, we also had, It raised eyebrows relative to, in the sheriff's judgment, what that meant. So we have recommended its deletion. The committee has agreed. And to qualify it further, it would read as such, a sheriff may deny a license if the applicant would be a danger to self or others or to the community at large as a result of the applicant's mental or psychological state as demonstrated by a past pattern of behavior or participation in full, so on. So it would be a qualifiable thing that is not a judgmental decision. Secondly, in terms of the appeals process, we also thought there should be clarification to the point that you have suggested of either a de novo review or referencing ORS 183, which is the review mechanisms, I think, currently.
That's the administrative law.
Yes, that's the administrative law section.
You don't want to get into that.
Well, we thought of a couple of different options that would be available.
Well, I mean, specify the procedure under Chapter 183. I'm just telling you, Chapter 183 is the Administrative Procedures Act, but that can get complicated.
Yeah, I understand what it is, but I'm not familiar with it.
All right.
That's a good question. That was one I wanted to raise. Was on the review of this, we're talking about potentially having an administrative review, which is basically the sheriff is the expert, and unless there's substantial evidence, which is also interpreted to be any evidence that the sheriff's ruling is going to be upheld by the court. If you're looking at this from an administrative standpoint, that's the kind of review you have, as opposed to potentially allowing the sheriff to deny, then requiring the court to make a whole new record on which the evidence has been raised for this as a foundation, and that would potentially be, well, that'd be appealable to the Court of Appeals and what have you. Finding of the trial court. You panel kind of understand the different directions we have to go on this. There's a substantial difference in the type of review you can have with matters like this.
Mr. Counsel, Chair, it seems to me that the intent of the working group was really to have a court review as opposed to administrative process. Based on my conversations with the state court administrator, it would seem to me that something patterned after small claims where, for example, no formal pleadings other than the claim form is necessary, that the hearing and disposition of all cases shall be informal, the sole object to be to dispense justice promptly. I mean, I think that there is, that if this committee looks at really the small claims process and there's language in the statute, I think that that would satisfy a lot of the concerns raised by the state court administrator. It would also clarify some things in terms of filing fees, timelines. You don't want to set up a whole new system, but at the same time, you want it as simple as possible. And I think that for guidance, and based on my conversations with Bill Linden, the small claims process is, I think, the closest to what the working group has envisioned.
Mr. Chairman,
want everybody to go in on equal footing, if I'm not mistaken.
Thank you, counsel. Representative Mannix.
I'd like to ask that our committee counsel work with legislative counsel on drafting something along those lines with two added factors. One is that small claims, that there be a special cheap filing fee, $5, because otherwise small claims people are looking for recovery money from other people, but in this case someone's been denied something by the state, and I don't want to hit them with the standard filing fee. And the other thing is timeliness. Small claims in some communities takes a long time to be heard, might take 6 weeks. I'd like to require that the hearing be held within 1 week